Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
It's exactly 5 p.m. here in Bonn, Germany. Hello and a very warm welcome to this edition of Africa Link. My name is Jane Nyinge.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. You're also live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Coming up, the families of dozens of girls missing for several days after Boko Haram attack in northeastern Nigeria wait anxiously after Demetrius said they had rescued them.
You know, even during the Chibok jail issue, that was the same thing that we have undergone. Government is trying to conceal the fact that Boko Haram is still raising havoc.
Also in the program, Transparency International releases its report revealing little attempts to combat corruption in some countries in the sub-Saharan region, but all is not lost.
You have the likes of Botswana, Namibia, the Seychelles, Rwanda. These are the countries that have done consistently well because the expression of political will went beyond word.
Well, these are some of the stories that we've lined up for you. But first, let's listen to what's been happening around the world.
I'm Kai Dombach with the DW News. Dozens of Nigerian schoolgirls were rescued from Boko Haram after they were taken hostage earlier this week. However, the national military also recovered the bodies of two girls and at least 13 students were still believed to be missing. The hostage situation sparked fears of a similar attack in Chibok in 2014, according to public analyst Felix Nikwag.
It's quite unfortunate that we're having a repeat of the Chibok tragedy yet again. This is happening at a time when a lot of people are asking questions. When are we going to have a stop to this? Lives disappear. For close to 4 years now, we've been asking questions. Where are the Chibok girls, the remaining ones? And the Yobe experience has come up. Can we beef up the security in this country and put a stop to young girls disappearing from schools on the streets?
The United Nations has called for an end to the Syrian government's assault on opposition-held Eastern Ghouta. The assault, which was supported by Russian warplanes, has left more than 300 dead since Sunday. That includes 13 deaths on Thursday morning after more than 200 shells rained down in the region. This is considered one of the most intense bombing campaigns of the seven-year conflict. At least 172 people have died in South Africa due to an ongoing listeria outbreak. The National Institute of Communicable Diseases said there were 915 confirmed cases of the foodborne illness since January. The government said the source of the outbreak was still unknown. South Africa's Gauteng province has seen most of the reported cases, followed by Western Cape. This news comes to you from Deutsche Welle, Germany's international public broadcaster. The anti-corruption group Transparency International said more than two-thirds of governments around the world are corrupt. The worst-performing area in the world was sub-Saharan Africa, with 4 of the 10 most corrupt countries coming from the region. Somalia was deemed the most corrupt nation in the world, while New Zealand was the least corrupt. Human rights group Amnesty International urged for more human rights protections in its annual report. The organization also warned that populism has eroded human rights around the world. Tirana Hassan, Crisis Response Director of Amnesty International, said 2017 would not be remembered fondly.
It seems abhorrent, but the international community, when they look back at 2017 and they look at how they could have prevented mass atrocities, how they could have responded to crimes against humanity, they will not look back and draw any lessons from this. They will look back and they will see that they were part of the drafting of some of the darkest chapters in modern history.
An elderly couple has been kidnapped in eastern South Africa, police said Thursday. The kidnappers are suspected to be associated with the so-called Islamic State, but police would not comment on a possible link. Two suspects have been arrested in relation to the abduction. For more news and information, please visit our website at dw.com. I'm Kai Dombach.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link program. My name is Jane Nyinge.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. We begin the program in Nigeria, where families of dozens of girls missing for several days after Boko Haram attack on their school in northeast Nigeria faced an anxious wait for their return after confirmation some had been rescued. Police said that 110 girls from the state-run boarding school in Dapachi Yobe State were unaccounted for following an attack by the jihadists on Monday night this week. One parent, Jose Abana Hamido, told DW that they've received reports that some of the girls have been rescued. Take a listen.
The status of the missing girls as at now, some of them have been rescued. We have not got the list of those who are rescued, and even the list of those who have been adopted. Now we want to follow another way to get this list.
Very sad indeed, Isaac, listening to that parent.
Exactly. They're still waiting for their girls. Anyway, the disappearance sparked fears of a repeat of the 2014 mass kidnapping of more than 200 girls from a similar school in Chibok in neighboring Borno State. The parent we've just heard, Jose Abana Hamido, also downplayed the government's downgrading of Boko Haram and thinks that the Nigerian government is concealing some information concerning the missing girls. Jane, I think it was sad to hear him, say uncertain about, these girls, their daughters missing.
Absolutely.
And the same case. Anyway, let's listen to him again.
Even during the Chibok girl issue, that was the same thing that we have undergone. Government is trying to conceal the fact that Boko Haram is still raising havoc, because they have just spoke last week, just 3 or 4 days ago, that they have completely degraded Boko Haram and there is no longer any Boko Haram. And immediately after their declaration, Boko Haram is doing such a thing. So they want to confirm it from the other world that what they are saying is the truth, while look at what is happening.
That is one of the parents of the kidnapped girls, Jane. And of course, this attack again raises questions about the government's grip on security in this part of the country. I know we've been following, this story, and many people are commenting on this story even on our Facebook page, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. And we have Rich Choco Brown. He says the Nigeria president has just started another missing girls drama so that they can vote him he can get in.
And Justin says, but the parents are saying different story, that the Nigerian army report should be ignored, that no girls have been rescued. Of course, there are some concerns that, the girls are still missing.
Absolutely. And we have this one from Soso Progress, and he says, DW Africa, you know the truth. It's like you are working with Nigeria government, not the masses.
Well, we have our correspondents there for Soso Progress. Just to let you know that we have correspondents there following the stories. And as you heard in the report, we spoke to the parent himself. And he said it, what he thinks about the government itself.
We'll come to that much, much later. And moving on, international rights group Amnesty International has released its annual report warning of increased violations of human rights being perpetrated by some global leaders, including U.S. President Donald Trump. The 400-page report also highlighted atrocities, including Myanmar military crackdown on Rohingya, killings of innocent civilians in South Sudan, and government crackdown on dissidents in Cameroon. Earlier, I spoke to Netsat Abale, Africa Program Director at Amnesty International, and he starts by telling us how the continent fared in this year's report.
The continent once again saw a continuation of extreme intolerance expressed in the form of attacks against peaceful protests, arrest and prosecution of journalists, brokers, and human rights defenders. Secondly, and much worryingly, is also the continuing impact of violent conflict in Africa, which has resulted in displacement of millions, the deaths of millions. These conflicts still continue unabated. We've seen in over 20 countries, including in Angola, Chad, DRC, Ethiopia, Sudan, Togo, where people were denied their right to peaceful protest. In over 30 countries, journalists and media was restricted. We also saw direct attacks against human rights defenders and activists. In Cameroon, where civil society activists, trade unionists were attacked, and in Eritrea, thousands of activists remain in jail. So there are many countries that we're citing as examples that show this growing intolerance. patterns of dissent.
And is there a political will in those countries to get human rights at the level expected internationally?
It's a mixed picture, really. I mean, I think by and large, our concern is that governments are not learning from past mistakes. Particularly in the conflict areas, we really don't see sufficient political will. In South Sudan, as you may see, the promised hybrid court for South Sudan, which was supposed to be set up by the African Union, still is not realized. So in those countries, you see a significant lack of political will to address these violations.
Now, if we come from another perspective, all is not doom, because there are also positive stories coming from Africa. Where can we get those good examples when it comes to respecting human rights?
Of course, there are quite a lot of encouraging reforms made in a number of countries. If I can give an example, for instance, in Gambia, it freed a number of political prisoners. If you also look at Burkina Faso and Mali, these are countries who have adopted a unique instrument to protect, specifically protect human rights defenders. Regionally as well, we've seen quite ambitious promises coming from the African Union to address the scourge of conflict in Africa. So it's not all doom and gloom, as you said. Indeed, there are pockets of reforms that are showing positive reforms towards protection of human rights.
That was Netsanet Bale, Africa Program Director at Amnesty International.
And as you've heard, he said that there are some reforms in some countries. And the group said Nigeria, the Gambia and Kenya are some of the countries where human rights are fairly respected. And we asked you, what's your opinion? Well, many of you were quick to answer us. Desmond says, I think that Amnesty's report is very correct, especially in the case of Cameroon.
And Joseph agrees with Desmond. He says they are 100% correct, because in Cameroon, if you are caught with SMS joking about something, even if you are you are 10 years old, you'll be beaten and sentenced to life imprisonment.
John from Nairobi says, I agree with the findings and feel better knowing my country. However bad it might seem at times, it still respects human rights. Anyway, many thanks for those comments. And from Amnesty International report to Transparency International, that has revealed that some countries in the sub-Saharan regions have made little attempts to combat corruption, especially in public institutions, while others are moving too slowly in their efforts. In addition to that, countries with the lowest protections for press and non-government organizations also tend to have the worst rates of corruption. Somalia and South Sudan have perennially maintained their positions at the bottom of the index, largely due to civil conflict. However, there are also other countries in Africa that have greatly improved and feature prominently on the index, as explained by Samuel Kaninda, Regional Coordinator for West Africa at Transparency International.
In terms of the countries that are performing well, we could categorize them in two. There are those who have consistently been above the average score, which is that of 50. You have the likes of Botswana, Namibia, the Seychelles, Rwanda. These are the countries that have done consistently well, even Cape Verde. And why is that? In the case of the improvers, we would say because the expression of political will went beyond words. It went beyond passing laws and establishing institutions to the extent of making sure that those laws and institutions effectively work for the mandate for which they were set up.
Some of the countries that really underperformed have a tendency of also clamping down on media freedoms and civil rights. Why is this?
This is because the media, when it enjoys its freedom, is able to investigate cases of corruption based on tips they may get. And this becomes a thorn in the flesh of those who are actually corrupt, be it in the public sector or even the private sector, in cases where you have collusion between the two sectors. So it would be in the interest of those who are corrupt in the system to clamp down on the media, and in some cases it could even get up to the point of eliminating them.
And how is your organization working with countries perceived to have high levels of corruption, I mean, to change for the betterment of their people?
In some cases, we would have contacts, but in others, it would be tricky. In countries where we have national chapters, in the case of the DRC, in Congo Brazzaville, we have chapters there.
That was an official from Transparency International, Samuel Kaninda. And of course, we have one comment. Gola Claude says, if there was a way to the synonym of corruption as Cameroon, then it would sound better. Many thanks for those comments and keep them flowing on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Welcome back to the program, and in case you've just joined us, this is DW's Africa Link program coming to you straight from our studios. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jane Nyingi. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, we will be hearing the plight of refugees in the Central African Republic being protected from marauding militia by the UN peacekeepers.
Moi, vraiment...
That I can stand here today is only by the grace of God. They attacked us. They took me to the forest. They burned the whole village and they burned the school.
And as you've heard from that, you know, refugee, this is one of the so-called forgotten refugees, Jane. And at this moment, we'd like, you know, to let our listeners know they can comment on these stories. They tell us about, you know, what they think that, you know, the world should
do.
To help them, you know, go back home.
Yeah, but first let's head to Sierra Leone, and as it prepares to go to the polls on the March 7th, the police have slammed a restriction on vehicle movement on election day. Political parties had earlier issued a joint statement condemning the decision, but they are now about to agree on certain terms following intense consultations with the civil society and the police. But this isn't the first time the Sierra Leone police is proposing or implementing such a restriction to ahead of national elections. This report by Claudia Anthony is now presented by Eddie Micah Jr.
The spate of election-related violence was disturbing as the country prepared for national elections in 2012 and the police decided to restrict vehicular movement. Although there was a mild disagreement by the opposition then, it was generally accepted to be a step taken in the interest of the country's peace and stability. Even before election-related violence broke out this year, the Sierra Leone police has once again restricted vehicular movement on Elections Day, 2 weeks away. The Inspector General of Police, Dr. Sir Richard Moigbe, explains how vehicular movement will be managed.
People will not be allowed to mill or loiter around polling centers or stations after voting. It is an offense under the electoral laws. And on that day, because private vehicles or vehicles that are not accredited will not be allowed, we are very mindful about people being in distant areas. They have to move to the polling centers or stations, and also the aged, the physically challenged people. So we have made arrangements to provide free transportation on that day across the country per district, a total of 70, the very big buses. So for the 70 buses to be utilized to transport people to and from the polling centers is costing us or government 185 million, and that money has been provided.
There are people who support the move by the police, arguing it would help reduce political confrontations and violent behaviors on election day. Others don't, however, see the need for the vehicular restriction.
For you to impose people's restriction on people's movement means you are either indicating to the public that there is something hidden that is bound to create tension and potential trouble. We may not know what is behind it. There are a couple of things that are involved. If they could come out clearer why they want to restrict vehicles, that would be, all of this argument will not come up. But if you just say it like that, people become suspicious, especially when on a sensitive matter like elections.
The most confounding dismay of pronouncement in this country is to say that one has to go home after an election. When we have had election in a most difficult time, like during the war, nobody went home. There was no restriction on movement of vehicles. So I wonder how could, in a peaceful country like this, in the 21st century, we could have a ban on vehicles and movement on an election day.
While the electorate is discussing the latest move by the police, there have been a few political skirmishes over the past week, one involving an alleged attempted assassination of the presidential candidate for the Sierra Leone People's Party, the country's leading opposition party. Despite such incidents, the Inspector General of Police, Sir Richard Moigbe, has assured the electorate that his force is ready to handle any violent incidences.
The people of Sierra Leone This is an assurance and a commitment to all of you and the international community that the Sierra Leone police has been well capacitated, resourced, and well motivated. And we have prepared, we are ready, we are willing, we are capable to provide a very safe, secured, and enabling environment for the conduct of a peaceful election on 7th March 2018.
The National Electoral Watch, an independent civil society election watchdog, has also promised peaceful campaign period and the Syria police to speedily investigate and bring those culpable to face the law.
That report was compiled by Claudia Anthony in Sierra Leone.
Uzon.
Now to Ghana, where the International Organization for Migration, IOM, has started a campaign to discourage young people from making the dangerous journey to get to Europe. The Aware Migrants campaign involves powerful testimonies from migrants and refugees revealing the abuse they endured during their transit across the Mediterranean. Despite Ghana being peaceful, it's ranked among sub-Saharan Africa countries with a high number of those migrating to Europe illegally. From Tamale, Ghana, Maxwell Souk reports with the details.
It is early in the morning at the lorry station in Suyani, capital of the Burkina Faso region in Ghana. Thomas Nkatia is busy selling wristwatches and spectacles. He confidently calls out for customers, and after asking him why he has become a hawker, he tells me it is because he is an unsuccessful migrant.
I'm going to Libya. Because of Gaddafi fighter, we came back. If you came back to Ghana, if you come back, no sort of work. This is my business. I'm a hustler. This time, I'm straight to sell for this market.
Thomas is not an exception in this region. Kennedy Amponsa is also a returnee. Before he left in 2015 for Libya, just like many other irregular migrants, he prepared 2 months ahead, restraining himself from food and water to enable him go through the desert.
I made my preparation like 2 or 3 months ahead. How to go without food or water for days. My clothing I will put on because I know that road is not a tarred road. You can't just get up and go if you don't prepare yourself. If you do that, you will die.
The Burkina Faso region has the highest number of irregular migrants leaving Ghana. In 2017, Ghana's Immigration Service recorded over 19,000 applications of people who wish to travel to Libya and the Gulf states. Superintendent Alhassan Haruna is the director of Passport Division at the Ghana Immigration Department in Sunyani. He said migration is widespread in the region.
It's a consistent thing, you understand, because as we speak now, you will be surprised that there are people on the road traveling to Libya. Tomorrow you get people. Tomorrow next you get it. So it's a daily, weekly, monthly affair.
And that has had a huge impact in this region. At least every household here has someone who have migrated before. This is why the government set up the Migrant Information Center in Sunyani to help prospective migrants with adequate information. Migration Control Officer Grigory Eshim said the center has had more than 10,000 people visiting it since it was started in 2016.
We bring them to the office and then we talk to them and we teach them the right way of traveling, how to apply for a passport, how to apply for a visa, what are the things you need to look out for, what kind of information that you need to have before you travel to someone's town. So these are the things that we do here in the center.
Ghana's unemployment rate, which stands at nearly 6%, is often cited for the main reason why young people choose to migrate. Recently, the Ghanaian government said it will focus on providing skills for the youth to counter unemployment and the wave of migration.
Maxwell Souk reporting from northern Ghana in Tamale.
And now, Isaac, over 5,000 Ghanaians illegally crossed to Italy through the Mediterranean in 2016.
Yeah, and it made Ghana come in the 11th position among those migrants who have arrived on the shores of Italy. And of course, Jane, this is why we asked, is it really worth the risk taking such a dangerous route to Europe.
And there is this interesting comment from Jonathan. He says, West Africans are so obsessed with Western life or development, which they have failed in their own countries.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jonathan, for that comment. Beatrice Cruz says, we'll keep on asking why they're running away from here. Most of them don't even have nice jobs. They just want to earn a name that their relatives are abroad.
And I have this interesting one from Yusuf Ibrahim Tahim, who says, people apply for visas and they get refused. I mean, the visas, the applications are rejected. That could be the biggest problem, according to him.
Then Felipe Felix Lorata says, refueled. This is craziness. Africans, let's wake up. He has a very strong statement there. Anyway, thanks for those comments. We'll be back with a bang this time after this.
Speaking out.
Now, the conflict in the Central African Republic has displaced over 1 million people, and there is no end in sight. Fighting between rival militias have forced them to flee their homes. According to the United Nations, over 2.5 million people are in dire need of assistance. They lack access to clean water and food. The situation is particularly bad in the country's northwest region, but even in the south, entire areas have been abandoned by people who fled to neighboring Congo. The Red Cross warns that very soon as much as half of the population will need humanitarian aid. Here's a report by Eugen Schneider.
It's the first plane seen in months, and it's eagerly awaited here in the refugee camp of Kagabandoro in the north of the Central African Republic. It has been sent by the International Red Cross, and it brings urgently needed relief and supplies. 30,000 people live in the camp on the outskirts of the city of Kagabandoro. They have not come from far away. Most come from within the Central African Republic, and some even come from the city itself. UNICEF has set up an emergency school in the middle of the refugee camp. It consists of several large tents. More than 80 children are sitting in one of the crowded school tents, squeezing on a few benches and old chairs. Daniel Dambiti is the teacher. He is 48, but looks much older. He has already spent 4 years in refugee camps.
That I can stand here today is only by the grace of God. They attacked us. They took me to the forest. They burned the whole village and they burned the school. They killed my brother. So it's a blessing that I'm still alive.
Daniel Dambiti is not the only one. Most of the children in the room have had to flee violence several times.
Some have lost their fathers, some have lost their mothers, some have lost brothers and sisters. Some of them, when they've got here, they didn't even have any clothes. And they are all very traumatized.
Like 12-year-old Lucie Velachou. She's shy and does not speak much.
I'm on my own now, and I live here with other people who also fled from my village.
Everything has also changed for 11-year-old Akile Sadahinya, who has spent years on the run.
Before, I had a very good life. I had many friends. We had great fun together. We studied together under a big tree. In the evening, we would dance and sing under the moon. Now, all of this is gone. Some of my friends are dead, and the others are scattered among different refugee camps.
The situation in the country remains difficult and hard to assess. Government influence hardly reaches beyond the capital, Bangui. Meanwhile, around 20 different armed groups are fighting each other across the country. For the foreseeable future, it seems that it is literally a lost country in the heart of Africa.
That was Eugen Schneider.
And before we wind up this edition, we remind you the main stories that we've covered. The families of dozens of girls missing for several days after Boko Haram attack in northeastern Nigeria wait anxiously after the military said they had rescued them. And Transparency International says little countries have made little attempts to combat corruption in sub-Saharan region. With that, we come to the end. On behalf of my colleagues in the studios, I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And my name is Jane Nyingi.
Bye for now.